Are there new persons here not so familiar with what Srimad Bhagavatam is? Okay. Any others? Okay. There's one almost complete set of Srimad Bhagavatam recently arrived here at Penn State. Srimad Bhagavatam was written, compiled by Vyasadeva, a literary incarnation of Krishna. He also wrote Bhagavad Gita, which is part of one of the books on that shelf over there, the Mahabharata, History of Greater India. And Srimad Bhagavatam is very special literature. Nigama Kalpataraar Galitam Palam. It's the ripened fruit of the Vedic tree of knowledge. It's a commentary. It's many things. It's a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Vedanta Sutra is in code form or sutra form, the essence of all the Vedas, but because it's in a code form, it's very difficult to understand. So the explanation of Vedanta Sutra, that code form of all the Vedas, is the Srimad Bhagavatam. These things are described within various portions of the Vedic literature. They provide a commentary on Gayatri Mantra in the Rig Veda. Gayatri Mantra is a very exalted and traditional standard Vedic mantra. And to understand Gayatri Mantra, well, anyone can chant it. To understand it, its full meaning is another thing. And Srimad Bhagavatam is a commentary, includes commentary on Gayatri Mantra. In there are two verses. I had different ideas of what to do considering who's here. And what he ended up deciding to do is we'll just continue where I left off in sequence, because that was what the plan was, and I think that's appropriate. I've been covering the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. There's 12 cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, 18,000 verses, which really is Bhagavad Gita. That's 700 verses. 700 verses goes into 18,000 verses a bunch of times. There's that many Bhagavad Gita in one book. So the Bhagavatam is considered the graduate study of Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is undergraduate study, and Bhagavatam is graduate study. And it's postgraduate study too. So the message that's in Bhagavad Gita, for the correlation, you'll see from the verses that we're discussing, there are some messages in Bhagavad Gita that are in basic form, and then the Srimad Bhagavatam expands the meaning. Like, you know, it's not that in graduate school 2 + 2 = something other than 4. But what you can do with math and multiplication tables and add, addition, and subtraction tables becomes far more sophisticated and advanced mathematics. So similarly, advanced studies of spiritual science is presented in Srimad Bhagavatam. So these 12 cantos of the Bhagavatam are described in Padma Puran as the literary incarnation of the Lord. The first two cantos being the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead in this literary incarnation. Pada Padma. The lotus feet of the literary form of the Lord. So if one can approach the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, you're in good shape, because then you have this whole spiritual form by taking shelter in the lotus feet. And there's something very important in taking shelter of the Lord's lotus feet, and that is a proper mood of humility and service. And so those moods are brought out, highlighted, by the first two cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. And as you go through them consecutively and very with great attention and devotion, you feel that service mood and humility increasing experientially within. The messages have that potency. So it's not a matter of, in fact, the verses that we're going to cover explicitly say, it's not a matter of intellectual competence, and then you can understand. It's not a, understanding spiritual knowledge is quite the opposite of, or the absence of, intellectual brain power. Rather, it's entirely a matter of the condition of devotion with transcendental knowledge, recognizing who the object of devotion is, but the eagerness to serve and render whatever it is that we have in service to the Personality of Godhead. That's our eligibility for understanding Srimad Bhagavatam. That's brought out in the two verses that we're going to cover this evening. Express that. The chapter that I was discussing during the Gita Nagari retreat during the Labor Day weekend, I didn't get a whole lot further. Chapter 6 is Purusha Sukta confirmed, and if all goes well, we'll complete Chapter 6, Purusha Sukta confirmed. So this is like the finale of the whole thing. So Purusha Sukta, there are standard verses found in the Rig Veda. The Vedas, when they were originally compiled or divided by Vyas, they were present previously by oral tradition, just by sound. The Vedas were manifested by the rishis, who were able, they had receivers. They could hear spiritual sound, and they then manifested those sounds through their mouths, and they would vibrate the Vedas, and then students would hear those Vedas, and then they would become the by generation, the bearers of that Vedic wisdom. And that was how the Vedas were received, and that's how they were understood, by oral transmission. And as the ages cycle and pass, the present age that we're in was to begin, the age of Kali. Kali means quarrel. If you haven't noticed, there's a little bit of quarrel going on in the planet today. And not just between the Democrats and the Republicans, there's quarrel in every corner, in every household, between nation and nation, and man to man, and all over the place. So prior to this age of Kali, the knowers of the Vedic wisdom understood that qualities of the human society would deteriorate very rapidly. And along with the qualities of human society, the capacity to understand the knowledge of the Vedas. And so one of the things that was done was, because memory is very short, the Vedas were written down from the oral tradition to the written tradition, a written form. And in fact, it was one Veda, and it was divided into four parts. One of those four parts is Rig Veda. One part of Rig Veda is Purusha Sukta prayers. Sukta indicates prayers. It's a certain type of prayer. A prayer that's glorifying Purusha, Purusha means the Supreme Lord. In the Purusha Sukta prayers, they disclose how from the spiritual realm this entire cosmic manifestation in its detail, step by step, sequentially became manifest. It's quite a different approach than what the modern scientists are going through, the, you know, going, trying to build it backwards. Anyway, that information is within the Purusha Sukta prayers. And the Srimad Bhagavatam explains and confirms the Purusha Sukta prayers in this chapter 6. And it's fantastic. It's very, in one sense, there's parts of it that are technical, because, you know, how did it happen is technology. It's a lot of understanding of cause and effect, and then the effect becomes a cause of the next effect, which becomes the cause of the next effect, and there's this kaleidoscope or domino effect of how it happened. It happened from subtle, and subtle unfolds into the next less subtle, and that next less subtle unfolds into the next less subtle, and next thing you know, you have the energy of material creation from an unmanifest subtle state of material energy. Subtle, the avyakta becomes vyakta. And there's sequential steps of that happening. But it's not mindless or directionless. It's caused by spiritual events that then create that unfolding of the material creation. And Purusha is that spiritual personality that kicks the ball off. Kicks the ball onto the field, and then the other players start running around taking the ball. And he sets the rules. He blows the whistle and puts people in the penalty box, and he's arranging the whole material creation. And again, he withdraws it. So how the Purusha Sukta prayers are described in the Bhagavatam, because this is history, it's Purana, it's narrated in the form of Narada asking his father, Brahma, "My dear father, are you not the creator of everything that exists? Surely you're the creator, because I see that everything has come into being from you. But then I also see that you're engaged in some meditation. And upon whom are you meditating? Is there somebody above and beyond you that you're meditating upon? Are the energies of creation with which you created coming from you alone, or are they coming from some other source? Is the plan for creation your plan, or is the plan some other plan from which you've derived the plan? In other words, are you the engineer, or are you the architect?" And how does all of this work? If you think that I'm qualified to understand, please explain. So he explains how he confirms in detail what in short form is in the Rig Veda, in the Purusha Sukta prayers. And so, after completing the whole explanation, which is where the technical part comes, he then says, "I've answered your question, and please know that," he says things, listen carefully, because it seems it's very beautiful, but subtle. So many beautiful things are subtle. He says, "Whatever it is that I told you, it's absolutely correct." He's not speaking out of pride. He's saying, because I've by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, received shelter of the Supreme Lord, I've grasped hold of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, and by contact with the Supreme Lord, He's now in control of my senses and my mind. And therefore, whatever it is that I say, He has disclosed it to me, and therefore it's infallible. Now, I'm not, put it in simple language, Prabhupada once said, if you want perfect knowledge, you have to find a perfect person. You can get perfect knowledge from a perfect person. So Brahma's saying, it's not that I'm perfect, but the person from whom I receive knowledge is perfect. And I've tightly caught hold of his lotus feet, and by that contact, whatever it is that I'm speaking to you is correct. And now it's your duty, because I'm delivering this knowledge, I'm the teacher, you're the student, and so as the student, I know what you do, Narada. You're going to go all around the universe and give messages to people, so it's now incumbent upon you to give the very same message unchanged. Then he goes through what seems like a contradiction to what he just said by saying that although I have the following qualifications, for 1,000 celestial years I underwent austerities that no one else could undergo, although I'm the most learned person in all of the universe, although I am the original father, the preceptor, Prajapati of all living beings, I can tell you that the personality of Godhead is hardly known by me. Now, the previous statement is, whatever I'm saying is true. And that statement is also true. Then he goes through more clarification of this point. Whatever high-grade activities there may be following me through the knowledge of the Vedas, there are so many elevating, beneficial activities that one can do, and he lists a whole long list of them. They're insufficient also to know the absolute truth, because what he's just described is the absolute truth. And from Vedic definition of what is the absolute truth, the absolute truth in Vedanta Sutra, which Srimad Bhagavatam is a commentary of, the absolute truth is that from which everything else comes. Atato Brahma Jigyasa. So we have many truths in this world, and by Vedic standard, this idea of truth doesn't just mean, like, you know, the book is resting on the book stand is resting on the rug, and the rug is resting on the floor. Those are true statements. It's not that kind of truth. It's the truth, the import is that which causes something. There's an effect and there's a cause, and the cause is a truth. That sense. So the absolute truth is that which causes all things and itself is not caused. Yeah?
Is it like an ultimate reason, maybe?
Ultimate reality. Ultimate existence. An existential cause of everything. So we can say, you know, air passing through my vocal cords and my mouth in a certain shape and tongue and teeth in a certain shape, certain sounds come out. That's the cause of those sounds. So that's a causal principle. Then you can go, what's the cause of that? What's the cause of that? What's the cause of that? What's the, just keep going back and back and back and back. And when you can't go any further, you found the cause of everything. The Vedas are pursuing that. Brahma is disclosing what the cause of all causes is, what the absolute truth is. Now, I hope you like philosophy, because this is philosophy. Purusha Sukta confirmed. In the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, we're going to discuss a little bit the correlation between Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. In the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, nobody can know me. Nobody can know me because even the great sages, the four Kumaras, and the sages following them, the seven great sages, and all the demigods, and all the downstream personalities, nobody knows me. And the reason is that nobody knows me is I existed before they existed. And you can't know the existence of something before you existed. You can guess. Before I existed, such and such. It seems to me that da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You don't know. You can't confirm. With your senses, you can't prove. With your reason, you can't prove. You can say, perhaps, maybe. It seems to me a likely explanation is. But no proof. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. Unless there's disclosure from that which existed before you existed. So that's Narada's program. Narada's saying to his father, aren't you the original? Or not? If not, what's the program? How does it work? Where do you get your energy from? Where do you get your ability from? Where do you get the plan from? Who are you meditating upon? What's going on? What's the absolute truth? You're up there. Are you the supreme or not? So Brahma discloses, no, I'm not supreme. Before I existed, this is what existed. And he's saying, the statement that I'm making, what existed before I existed, is true because it came from that which existed before I existed. From Purusha, the supreme person who is, as described in the Purusha Sukta prayers of the Rig Veda, is an expansion of the Supreme Lord in the spiritual world that's far beyond this material world, which is discussed in the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita also. Well, yeah. Oh. Book of Mormon.
Yep.
Get a partner with it. Come on in. We saved a seat for you. We're discussing the description of creation from this book, Srimad Bhagavatam, and its correlation book, Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita you've heard of, right? Somewhere along the line. But this is a more detailed explanation of that Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita, you probably have seen, is about this big. And this Srimad Bhagavatam has 60 volumes this big. Some of it's over there where someone has just purchased a collection of the Srimad Bhagavatam set. So we're discussing one little portion of it. About creation, picture of creation from. So the Purusha Sukta prayers are they're the same prayers that when Mother Earth, who is disturbed, the description of Krishna's appearance, Krishna's Janmashtami. Mother Earth takes the form of a cow. She goes to the demigods. They go to Brahma. Brahma, please help. The earth is overburdened with demoniac kings. Too much burden. So Brahma goes to the shore of the milk ocean where Lord Vishnu resides, and he offers, along with the demigods, the Purusha Sukta prayers. They're prayers that are glorifying the person who is the creator of this material world. Brahma is explaining those Purusha Sukta prayers. He is describing in detail how the creation unfolds, and so after explaining that, he discusses why he is able to understand that which existed before he existed. It's not based on best guess. It's based upon the revelation from the personality Godhead. Then he goes through a description that which kind of bringing us up to the two verses that we had like to discuss. He explains that material qualification, however high it may be, however pious, however religiously elevated one may be, it's not a qualification, it's not sufficient qualification to understand. Or as Brahma Samhita, Lord Brahma says, Vedeshu Durlabham Adurlabham Atma Bhakta. By depth of study of the Vedas, the scriptures, Durlabham, it's very difficult to understand the Supreme, but Adurlabham, very easy, Atma Bhakta, by devotee, by one who is devoted to the Supreme. So the principle that Brahma is describing here is the qualification of devotion. And with the qualification of devotion, that which cannot otherwise be understood can be understood, at least to some degree. And so he's explaining to his son, Narada, and directly, and to us, indirectly, that the qualification for understanding the scripture, or understanding God, or understanding Purusha Sukta, or understanding the Vedas, or understanding what's what, is by the incremental degree, the qualification that one may have in devotion to the Supreme. And devotion to the Supreme is far more than just a sentiment or feeling. It's a way of life. It's what you do. It's the consciousness that you carry as you do the things that you do. It's devoting yourself to the Supreme in every feature of life. So, the two verses, and this is all that's just to carry you up to speed where I left off in Maryland before coming here. Because I thought, I said I would just continue where I left off. So Brahma is speaking to Narada. Brahma says, and he's the original preceptor of our disciplic succession, just like, you know, Joseph Smith. Only Brahma's position as for the Mormons, he delivered the message to those who were his followers. In this case, this is Brahma, who is the original preceptor, and he also happens to be, according to the Vedic picture of things, Vedic scriptures, the firstborn living being, directly born from the body of the Supreme Lord. So he is describing to one of those progeny who came from him. Let us offer our respectful obeisances unto that Supreme Personality Godhead, whose incarnations and activities are chanted by us for glorification, though he can hardly be fully known as he is. So this is just emphasizing something that he said earlier. That which is beyond the senses can't be known by the senses. That which is beyond the mind cannot be known by the mind. But the soul is intimately connected to the Supreme, and through revelation, that to the degree that one has connection with the Supreme in devotion, one can know. That's the message. I'll read a little bit of the purport. It is said that the transcendental name, form, quality, pastimes, paraphernalia, personality, etc. of God cannot possibly be perceived by gross material senses, it cannot be perceived because they're not made of matter. They're more subtle. Spirit is more subtle than matter. So through the material mind and material senses, the Supreme cannot be perceived. But when the senses are purified by the process of hearing, chanting, remembering, and worshipping the lotus feet of the holy deity, etc., the Lord reveals himself proportionally to the advancement of the quality of devotional service. And he quotes Bhagavad Gita, Yayata Mam Prapadyante. Yayata Mam Prapadyante comes to Tandra Pajamiham. Mamavart Manavartante. Krishna is explaining all living beings as they prapadyante, as they surrender unto me, I reciprocate accordingly. So proportionate to the love and devotion and submission unto the Supreme, according to our regard for the Supreme, our love for the Supreme, he discloses himself. That way he can be known. Proportionate to our devotion. One should not expect the Lord to be an order-supplying agent who must be present before us as soon as we desire to see him. Stamp our little foot and say, not like that. He must be ready to undergo the prescribed devotional duties, following the path shown by the predecessors in disciplic succession from Brahma, Narada, and similar authorities. Both Brahma and Narada, they were given some prescribed methods of purification. And they didn't whine and complain, saying, how come I have to do some? They performed. And they qualified themselves. And then, as they became qualified, two things, their impurities or limitations were cleansed away. And the other thing is their attraction, their eagerness for achieving shelter of the Supreme became stronger, stronger, stronger. And as a consequence of that purity and very strong spiritual aspiration, eagerness to achieve the shelter of the Supreme Lord, he disclosed himself to them. And then whatever they is that they spoke or did was from the place of realization. Not guesswork, speculation, or imagination. Purified senses, then one can see the realm of spirit. As the senses are progressively purified by bona fide devotional service, the Lord reveals his identity according to the spiritual advancement of the devotee. So the meaning here is, it's not just for, you know, somebody in the past, but it's for us. What applies to Peter applies to Paul. What applies to Brahma and Narada applies to us. The Bhagavatam is teaching that means by which we can also come to that stage of purification, at least incrementally. And the means are provided. The path is there. You know, the signposts along the path, there are plenty of them. And so Brahma is describing what he underwent and what he experienced and what we can expect also. But then the opposite side, one who is not in the line of devotional service can hardly perceive him simply by calculations and philosophical speculations. Such a hard worker can present a jugglery of words before an audience, but can never know the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his personal feature. Lord has clearly stated in the Bhagavad Gita that one can know him only in devotional service. Does anybody know that verse from Bhagavad Gita? Bhaktimam abhijana ti yavan yaschasmi tatpataha. Tatpataha, in truth, one can know me only by bhakya mam abhijanati, by devotion. And conversely, otherwise, not. So, just go over that one more time in context of the Bhagavatam. That's the Bhagavad Gita statement. What Brahma, to expand that understanding, has said is there are activities that can elevate one to the modes of nature, from the modes of ignorance and passion, qualitatively to the quality of goodness. And there's lots of those kinds of categories, and religions in the world are made up of those activities: sacrifice, charity, penance, austerity, truthfulness, cleanliness, acts of compassion. Activities that are within the Vedic practices of sacrifice, elevation, worship of different types that can not cultivation of knowledge. Abundant activities that can bring one to the quality of goodness and relieve one of the unfortunate condition of being covered with ignorance or passion. The message is, in that quality of goodness, it's not sufficient to know transcendence. The quality of goodness, a comparison can be made, is the difference between a wall and a window. In a wall, you can't, unless you're Superman or something, you can't see through the wall. And through a window, you can see what's on the other side of the wall. You're not there, but you can see. If it's raining, you can see. You're not experiencing the cold and the wind, you're just seeing what it's like. So the mode of goodness is like that. It gives one a picture of what's beyond this material realm. You can carry that within your mind, a picture of, but it's not the direct experience of. Transcendence is the direct experience of. But that's what the Bhagavatam wants to address and provide us the means to go to that position of transcendence. So Brahma is saying, for all the qualifications I have as the engineer of this entire cosmic manifestation, the entire universe, that's what Brahma does. He puts the whole thing together. In that sense, he's a creator. In that sense, he's a cause. In that sense, he's a truth. The Vedic sense from the earlier discussion that we had. He's not the absolute truth. He is the creator, but not the absolute creator, because he's deriving his ability to do the creation, the materials for the creation, the intelligence, how to put it all together, the Srishti Shakti, the impetus to do it, the enlightenment so he won't be in ignorance and false ego thinking I'm the creator. The perfect realization of what the whole thing is, who he is and who God is, it's all come from another source. And he's honoring that absolute truth, and here he's disclosing. One can only know that absolute truth even to the small, because we're very tiny also, and the absolute is unlimited. So in our tininess, we can know the absolute to some degree only, and to the medium of devotion. That's his message. He repeats three times in the purport, proportionate to one's development of the quality of devotion and service to him. He refers to an earlier verse. This is Canto 2 and Canto 1. Tach chadhana munayo jnana vairagya yuktaya tashyanti atmani chatmanam bhakya shruta vrihitaya. Nice verse. The shadhaya, you know the meaning of shadha's faith, touch Chadhadana Munayo, so that the thoughtful person who has deep faith in the Supreme, both knowledge and detachment come of their own accord. So what the meaning is that on the path of devotion, because of the quality of devotion, that very coveted thing called knowledge, and another very coveted thing, detachment of from materialism, materialistic way of living, it flows. It comes of its own accord. Yana vairagya yuktaya pashyanti atmani chatmanam. One directly perceives the Supreme, same as Krishna says in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. One directly sees the soul, bhaktya, shruta, that's the, by hearing, grahitaya, by hearing, by this process of hearing and chanting, in short, by what we're doing right now, and what Brahma and Narada are doing, and what the Bhagavatam involvement takes us down the path of, hearing and chanting the glories of the Supreme Lord, by that process one becomes qualified by those very coveted things, knowledge, detachment, but beyond, into the realm of transcendence where you can see the soul and see the Supreme Soul. That's what the path of bhakti holds. Then should I go to the next verse, or should I just stop and discuss? Hopefully, I'll go a little bit into the next one. Text 39. That supreme original personality and Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, expanding his plenary portion as Mahavishnu, the first incarnation, creates this manifested cosmos that he is unborn. So this is now recapitulating what, it's like a summary of the Purusha Sukta. Because, so the Vedic picture is, there's this vast spiritual sky. In this vastness of the spiritual sky, there are innumerable Vaikuntha planets presided over by forms of Narayan and the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi. In the whole vast spiritual sky, in one portion, there's a cloud of material energy, just like you might look in the sky, and some portion of the sky has this cloud. So the Vedic picture is this cloud of the material energy is called Mahatattva, and it's the material ingredients in their differentiated state. The Supreme Lord manifests this Mahatattva, but the purport is describing, by his own potency. That is, God, very perhaps obvious, but some persons don't get it, God has unlimited potencies. Say it the other way around. If one proposes that God cannot have unlimited potencies, there's no question of understanding God. You just neutered him, and if that's not what God is, you can't understand God without accepting inconceivable potencies, achintya shakti. And as soon as you have taken that little step of the inconceivable potencies of God, then anything is possible. Of course, according to his will, not according to our will. Anything he wants, because he has inconceivable potencies, and he doesn't have to do anything, he just wills it to be so, and voila, or bhavati, it is. And so this Mahatattva, the Vedic picture says, in the vastness of the spiritual sky, within this Mahatattva, an expansion of Krishna in one of these spiritual planets, in the Krishna Loka planet, from Krishna Loka planet, Krishna expands, or through Narayan, he expands Sankarshan, and Sankarshan expands Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu lies down in this Mahataka, or causal ocean, and then from Mahavishnu, the universes are generated from the pores of his body. This has been described already, so just summarizing it in this very succinct form. But what's going on here is describing the relationship between matter and spirit and the controller of both. There's matter, that's material creation, in its phases of unfolding. There's spirit, that's us, we're tiny spirit souls. There's a controller of both matter and spirit, that's Purusha. The first Purusha is Mahavishnu, and he's saying Mahavishnu is an expansion of Krishna, and Krishna is existing in the spiritual world, who doesn't get involved with matter at all. Mahavishnu does, as a service to Krishna, expands the universes, and those universes are undergoing constant transformation of energies. Constant. One thing is unchanging in the material world, and that is it's ever changing. Always changing. But Krishna is unchanging. That's his statement here. Although he's the cause of all this stuff that happens, which is all ever changing, he's unchanging. The purport explains, by, you know, cerebral power, you can't figure that one out. You can't, like, what's the relationship between the controller of both matter and spirit, and those, they exist on his energy. So this is now, maybe we'll do some more of this tomorrow morning, because it's a little heavy for evening, but everything exists in God's energy, and yet, and so, inseparable from God is all things. All things rest in his energies. Just saying the same thing backwards, in reverse order. At the same time, he has a separate existence, or his kingdom of God in the spiritual world, and he has nothing to do with this material world, because he's enjoying transcendental pastimes where there is no material energy, there is no time, there is no modes of nature, there is no karma. And that's his abode. Then, now that, go back to the other side. Yet, by his will, there's an expansion of Mahavishnu, there's an expansion of himself. Mahavishnu expands universes, and stuff happens. Only because he wills it to be so, yet he has nothing to do with the details of those things. By his expansion of Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshay Vishnu enters into each universe. By his expansion, Shirdakshay Vishnu enters within every atom and monitors every atom of existence. Nothing happens without the will of the Supreme, and yet he has his own separate existence. Those are contradictory things. You know, we'll cover it a little bit more tomorrow morning. 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, if you like to go through it ahead of time. Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, texts 4, 5, and 6. Krishna is describing, everything is resting in me, but I am outside of everything. It's like saying we're in the room and we're out of the room. Those are contradictory statements. We can't be in the room and out of the room. But Krishna can be within everything and simultaneously outside of everything. And that's by dint of his inconceivable potency, is this achintya shakti message. And so, just to end, Brahma is saying that this inconceivableness of God cannot be fathomed by intellectual brain power. nor by any amount of pious activities. It can be understood by devotion. And through devotion, one can understand him, as well as his energies, at least to some extent. And otherwise, it's baffling. So any questions you have?
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem like a contradiction.
Okay.
I mean, it seems like the way that I look at it is just to say, okay, well, the world is part of God, but, you know, there are other parts of God that extend beyond that. They're outside of it.
But the philosophically, the issue of God being responsible for the bad things that happen in this world is for some people an issue. God is all good. Okay, God is all good. And God is all powerful. God is all powerful. When bad things happen, bad things happen. So does that mean that God makes bad things happen, but he's all good?
Maybe they just think that.
Okay, well, then there's a philosophical way of exploring besides an ethical way of exploring. What's the relationship between the creation and God? That's what's the subject here in the Bhagavad Gita, in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. What's the relationship between God's energies and him?
This could be completely wrong, but the way I always thought about it, at least when I was reading Bhagavad Gita, was that the creation was part of God.
Yeah, you said that before. So that, so then, if it's the the philosophical thing is, if it's part of God, and it brings suffering to people, whether they're innocent or guilty, it brings suffering to people, then that's a part of God that causes pain and suffering. So he's responsible for the pain and suffering of people that are undergoing pain and suffering. And that's just part of God. It's just, you know, he brings pain and suffering to people. Then your idea is, but then there's another side of God, and that's the nice side, where there's no pain and suffering. It's to say it's part of God is correct, but not complete. More complete is these are energies that are just, according to the Purusha Sukta prayers and this chapter, it's just a portion of his energies. And the portion of those energies that make up this material world have a relationship, the Sanskrit word is bina, the separate. Or in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, bina prakritir ashtada, the separated energies, kind of like under remote control. They're moving over there, apart from the spiritual world. They're moving under his antiyaksha, his supervision. He didn't have to be directly hands-on involved, rather, just by his sanctioning anumanta, from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, he sanctions for things to happen. Now from within the heart of the living being, he's giving some other direction. The direction he's giving is, surrender unto me. Return to your loving relationship with me. Come once again to the spiritual world. That's the indication, the direct indication that he gives to all living entities. And then those living entities that say no, may not even say no thank you, they just say no, defiant. Then they have to deal with another energy of God, that's the material energy. And the material energy tells them, that's not, you didn't make the right choice. And then they complain, why are you bringing me suffering? Like a child that wants a toy and the parents say no. You can't have a knife, that you might hurt yourself. They cry. Why are you being mean to me? I want the toy. No. And so on.
So the toy is good for this round.
Yeah. So, but the material energy, yes, it's true that the material energy is a part of the existence of God. And there's another much grander, much more benevolent, much more inviting existence of God. But this, the relationship between that which is but a part of God has a very distinct relationship. It's separated energy. This is inferior energy. He has different categories of energies. And it's in the inferior category. It's not conscious. And it induces illusion if one regards that energy as having no connection at all with God. I mean, you know, as innocent as a wall might appear, or a tree, or the sunset, or anything that's a manifestation of the material energy. If it's seen apart from God, it has a bewildering potency. It covers the consciousness of the soul from their true, the true sense of what this thing is, and that is its relationship with God, the true sense of our relationship with God, if we have an ill disposition towards Him. It has a deluding potency. So, same question again. Well, then living at envy has to suffer, right? Because they don't recognize what the right thing to do is, so they do the wrong thing. And when they do the wrong thing, they suffer, because ignorance is the cause of suffering. So then God's responsible for their suffering, right? One goes down that logical path and then says, well, then I have an issue with God. Or maybe He doesn't exist. Or maybe so many things. Maybe He made a mistake. Or so many things that people say that don't have an understanding of the relationship of God's energies with Him. Doesn't change what happens or how those energies work. But so the value of this portion of scriptural study that the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita is presenting, and here the Purusha Sukta confirmed is presenting, it makes it very clear what the relationship of God's energies, the material energies, are. They're of Him, and you said they're part of Him, but they're in a specific category, they're separated energies, that if one sees them not in relation to Krishna, one begins to think that's all in all, and it's up for grabs because it doesn't belong to Him. It's like, you know, walking down the street and you see a $100 bill lying on the sidewalk. Look around, you know, who does this belong to? Because it doesn't belong to anybody, it goes in your pocket. The Prabhupada is described. There are three possible, maybe more, but three possible behaviors. You know that it belongs to somebody, not you, and just walk by. Doesn't belong to anybody, you put it in your pocket. Belongs to you now. And the third thing is to try to find out who it belongs to and return it to the owner. And you might have many persons claiming to be the owner. Who lost this $100 bill? But it's just it's describing a principle. So when we enter into this creation, we can try to make it ours. We can deny its existence, just be detached. Or we can try to understand where this energy comes from and use it in the service of its owner. And that's the devotional path. It's recognizing this is Krishna's energy. Use it in his service. So that's an interesting idea. How is it his energy? This chapter describes how that energy unfolds. Brahma, who is working with the energy to make the creation happen, describes. It's his energy. And if we take up a life of passing through this place, recognizing it's his energies, and there's prescribed ways to use it, prescribed ways to use our senses, to use our desire to eat something, our desire for procreation, our desire for intellectual activity, our desire for moving about. There are prescribed ways that you can use those things, those abilities and tendencies, in service to the Supreme, that will take you to the Supreme. And ignoring those things, then that you're entangled in a very complex arrangement, again according to God's laws. And it's that's not like he's mean. If you're not nice to him, he'll be mean to you. It's actually for the benefit of the living entity to correct them, set them on the path once again of returning to the spiritual world. And so the energies, the external energy acts in one way as a liberating field and the other as a binding principle under his direction. It's discussed in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, in the beginning of creation, I sent forth generations of men and demigods, and with them, the sacrifice by which they can make their lives perfect. And bless them. Perform sacrifice. Perform yajna. Whereby, in this world, all desirable things come, and it will carry you to the spiritual world once again. However, if persons ignore that message, then they get, you know, the entanglement in the complexities of the laws of nature. And the message with the entanglement of the complexities of material nature is, you made a mistake. Go back. Take some steps back to where you made the mistake and correct the mistake. Apply yourself to the principle of making sacrifice under the Supreme. And it's all happening under his direction. And it's not out of malice or vengeance or hurtfulness. It's to correct the misdirected ill tendencies of a living being. Like a loving parent might restrict their child or even command them out of a loving nature. Well, the child may not understand, hey, why are you restricting me? Okay, any other questions or thoughts on this?
I had a question.
Yeah.
Where are souls created by God?
Souls aren't created. Souls are eternal. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Anja, they're unborn.
So they have been like eternally existing with God.
Yeah, they're co-eternal. God means with, replete with his energies. Matter isn't created either. Einstein had it right. Matter is neither created nor destroyed. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. energy exists, and the energies of God are in different categories. The soul is marginal energy. Matter is inferior energy. And the spiritual realm is the superior energy. And they're eternal. Matter is sometimes unmanifest, sometimes manifest by the will of the Supreme. But the energy is eternal. It undergoes transformations, but the energy is eternal. The souls are eternal. It's like the sun and the sunshine. You're not going to have shine without sun or sun without shine. And the difference is that the sun is created. And the Vedas confirm what modern science also says. At one point the sun is going to be extinguished and then you don't have shine anymore. But Krishna doesn't come into being from this stating this, nor does he go out of being. And the souls that are the marginal potency of the Supreme Lord, they're coexisting with the eternal Supreme Lord, not created.
Continuing along his question, actually, Krishna says there was never a time when either of us never existed, so we have been existing all the time. Yeah. So he also says, you cannot understand me because you are not existent, because I was existent before you came.
Yeah.
So does it mean that in this body?
Yeah, that's what it means. So say the same thing in reverse. The knowledge of Krishna exists within us, but it's covered. We have forgotten that which we previously knew.
If the soul coexists,
good. They capture that point. The path of spiritual enlightenment is to reawaken that which we have forgotten.
But when Krishna says, I always have this question. When Krishna says, was never a time when you never existed, is it when you, there was never a time when you practically never existed, but actually...
That's speaking of the soul. Never was a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all the kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So you can go as far as you want to go that way in time, as far as you want to go that way in time, and at present. And so obviously the bodies, the time the bodies didn't exist, and time the future where the body will not exist, is speaking of the soul. But when the soul is covered, the soul cannot know, before this body existed, what existed, without disclosure. When there's disclosure, if one is in the right submissive mood, then it's not a matter of importing some data that's out there into your hard drive. It's already there. It's just, oh, now I have the password to get to that data. And that password is our submission. It's something that we already know.
It's a related thing, actually. Because if the souls have always existed, actually we were discussing this once, and just from a very speculative thing. I mean, if it existed, then does it mean that Krishna, who is all-powerful, does not have the potency to destroy a soul?
If God has all potency, does he not have the potency to destroy a soul? That's really Krishna has the potency to do whatever he likes, and he would not like to do such a thing. And therefore they're eternal.
Yes, that is.
And therefore they're eternal.
Always having eternal.
Krishna has the potency to do whatever he wants to do.
Right. So also one more question.
What? Can Krishna destroy himself? How valuable is that question? Krishna has the potency to do whatever he likes. His nature is he's loving.
So there must have been some time somewhere in minus infinity where...
Oh, please. Must you stay on the speculative platform forever? Doesn't it get lonely out there in the sky? It's useless. It's absolutely useless. Yeah.
But Krishna says, "Yatamam prapadam bhutam tatayo padam."
Yeah.
So then you said, as senses are purified, progressively God progressively shows himself, reveals himself.
Yeah.
So is there a state of complete purification where we can completely understand?
But that's discussed in previous verses. It's complete, even in the state of complete purification, it doesn't mean one can completely understand the unlimited. The tiny can understand the unlimited perfectly to a tiny degree, because we're tiny. And that's what Prabhupada is saying in the previous verses to Narada. Whatever I've said is perfect. It's not out of pride, it's the message of the Supreme. Then he says, perfectly true also, the Supreme is can be only limitedly known. And that's perfect knowledge. It's perfectly true.
If
Krishna wanted to, could he reveal himself completely? In minus infinity?
No. That was one of the questions.
Okay.
If we are restricted by our size, or since we are tiny, there could be a stage where to our capability we can understand completely.
Yeah.
So could when you made that statement, what came to my mind was when you were in one of the lectures trying to explain Hanuman Praman. There was this picture of an elephant with six blind men trying to understand the elephant.
Yeah.
And each one of them has a perfect understanding of a part of it, but the problem arises when each one of them thinks that this is the complete.
It's not even that they have perfect understanding within their limited purview either, because the information for the senses is also imperfect, and then unavoidably we process with the mind. So it's doing two things at the same time, the imperfect senses and then extrapolating, the elephant must be, because it just happened, it's just the process of the mind. It's speculation along with sense perception, both of which are imperfect.
So when Krishna gives the knowledge, he also gives the knowledge that okay, this is all you can understand, but there is more to it which you cannot understand. Does he also give that knowledge?
Yeah. He's giving it right here. And then capacity may increase. You know, like a 40 watt bulb and a 60 watt bulb and a 100 watt bulb. So, same electricity passing through, but different capacity, perhaps more illumination. So, you know, the capacity of yas to understand surpasses our capacity. He's an empowered incarnation of the Lord. So if the Lord so desires, he can increase our capacity. And that happens when there's some service to do. Vyasa was to compile the Vedas. Arjuna was to fight in the Kurukshetra battle. And after the Kurukshetra battle, sometime later, his prowess was so much less. And then it was with joy he could recognize, this was Krishna, not me. Not feeling defeated, oh, now I can't even fight anymore. It was because of his quality of devotion. And because of his quality of devotion, he was made so much more powerful for a particular service, purpose. So, and that's proportionate to our devotional service. Prabhupada was asked from time to time, you know, if one who becomes a pure devotee, does that mean you become the knower of everything? And then, you know, stump the Swami question, follow. How many grains of sand are there in the Sahara Desert? Yeah, trivia, 101. Prabhupada's answer is, how many drops of water are there in the mirage? To become the knower of all things does not mean that one is excellent in trivia questions, but that one understands the relationship of all things with Krishna and stays in that consciousness all the way back to Godhead. And Krishna supplies that intelligence, the Dhamma Bodhi Yoga, the knowledge by which one can come to me. Yeah.
Do we have time for more?
Sure. Okay. Okay. We'll take one more and then we'll have this Arti to the Bhagavatam quickly. Okay.
Why does Krishna exist?
Why does Krishna exist? Does Krishna need an existence? Does Krishna require a reason for existing? Krishna exists because he is. There's not a need for Krishna's existence. Our existence is based upon Krishna's existence. And Krishna's existence simply is. See, just thinking about this question I've never heard asked before, were there a need, then there'd be something beyond the absolute truth, and whatever that is would be the absolute truth. That there's a need, and then the effect of the cause is not the absolute truth. The absolute truth is that which is beyond. So the asking your question is like asking, everything comes from Krishna, so where does Krishna come from?
There is
no need for Krishna's existence. He just exists. And everything else exists coming from Krishna. Is there a need for Krishna's existence? No.
So why wasn't it that instead of Krishna, my finger just existed?
Why not? Because your finger isn't Krishna. Your finger doesn't exist without a need, without a cause. Your finger exists with a cause, and Krishna exists without a cause. And therefore your finger doesn't work as Krishna, or that which has no prior cause. And that's the nature of the absolute truth. Every other existence has a cause, some reason why it exists. Take away that reason and the finger will stop existing. The material body that's provided for the living entity will no longer be required when there's no longer material desire. So in the liberated position, there's no more fingers, these material ones. No more material bodies, no more material minds, no more material senses, no more taxes, no more election campaigns, no more winter and summer. But there's variegatedness in the spiritual world, and the variegatedness is full of truth, bliss and substantiality. And there's no need of fingers, material bodies, in that realm. Material bodies are needed because we want to enjoy independent of that realm for some mistaken reason, and so we get material body. And we can, the next question leads to the next question. So we can speak after.
Yes.
9:25. In honor of Srimad Bhagavatam appearing, we can have a short arti. We have arti paraphernalia because the Srimad Bhagavatam is a literary form of the Lord, a literary incarnation of the Lord, just as the name is a sound. We can have kirtan and appreciate Krishna's presence through his name. Krishna can be present through his deity form, Archavigraha, and his literary incarnation also. So as with the name, as with the deity, so also with the literary form of the Lord. As much as there's devotion, one can appreciate Krishna's presence in his name, Krishna's presence in his deity, and Krishna's made himself available sitting on that little table over there by the work of devotion of Vyas to compile and commentators to make their commentary and Prabhupada to translate those commentaries and make them available. So Krishna's making himself available in that form. So when you receive a person, or to speak of a great person, or to speak of God in your home, you honor them in suitable ways. to have a short RT. And I'm not sure, I can't simultaneously do the RT and sing. I can do one or the other. What would you like? I'll do the RT and you sing. Okay? You know what I'm saying? You the drum player?
No, it's on basic.
Okay, you do some basics, and then that's short. Then we'll take some shots.